everyone who loves books. This is Read On.
My name's Alison Kennedy, A.L. Kennedy, and you're listening to RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. I'm your host, Red Sale, and in this week's show, writer and broadcaster A.L. Kennedy tells me what spurs her on.
That's life. The nice comfy bit with 200 people who meet each other a lot in London is not reality. Life is quite complicated and then you die.
Giles and Victoria Curran reveal how they compiled an anthology of their father Alan Curran's best work.
And we thought that doing it that way would be quite a good way of almost reflecting his life in a biographical form as well as collecting the pieces.
Listener Paul Chanel gives me an educating Red suggestion with a musical flavour.
So it's sort of reportage. It's a person with a story and very successfully putting that story down onto paper.
And Mark Haddon tells us about life after the curious incident of The Dog in the Nighttime.
So The Pier Falls is my first collection of short stories, which have been written over the last, 8 or 9 years.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. Alison, or A.L., Kennedy is a prolific writer of novels, short stories, screenplays, radio dramas, essays and non-fiction. Oh, and she does stand-up comedy too. Unflinchingly honest, sometimes very dark, and often very funny, her work attracts the same response as Marmite. Her literary novels, such as Day and Serious Sweet, have won her prizes, praise and recognition. But, as I found out when she came to the studio, that's not why she writes. Alison Kennedy, welcome to Read On.
Glad to be here.
So, as I say in the introduction, you've written extensively in various forms.
Yeah, and why not? It's all telling stories about people. I can't do poetry, but my poetry is terrible, but everything else is at least functional. Sometimes it's that people will ask me, do you want to do blah, blah, blah? And it's like, oh, yeah, that sounds fun. And sometimes I want to do whatever. Scripts used to be difficult because you had to do lots of formatting to give them the correct layout. And now they've got clever software that does that for you. So that's now as sort of technically simple as typing anything else. So, yeah, why not? It's all fun. I mean, I like it all.
Do you find yourself exploring different parts of the human condition through long fiction or through your commentary pieces that you do for the radio? Different medication for different symptoms?
Yeah, kind of. And it's different ideas have suggest different forms. And sometimes you want to talk about the same thing in different ways. So if I was doing it in stand-up, it would be different to the way I would talk about it in prose, to the way I would give it to a character who's talking about it in a play. So usually I'll sort of know what form would be most sympathetic for which idea. If something comes to you to be expressed, you have to be very happy and work out how to make it very happy.
Do you read out loud your longer fiction and short stories, knowing that it will be a voice, either in somebody's head or read on an audiobook?
I don't read the stuff out loud. Hopefully it would read out loud well. I hear it in my head, as does everybody. When you read, you're hearing without hearing. All of the neurological tests that they've done, it's like imagining listening to music. A lot of the areas of your brain that would involve actual listening are triggered. For instance, you'll understand a pun when it happens on the page, whereas the page is the only place where a pun wouldn't happen, because you can tell that it's B-R-E-D or B-R-E-A-D, so it shouldn't really work. But you're partly hearing. You're sort of hearing a bit of the author's voice. If it's got a character that the author's talking about, there'll be the character's voice in their thinking and speaking or their worldview. And there'll also be your voice. So it's a kind of stranded rope of sound that's happening. But it is all to do with voice, because that's what you tell stories with. And it's how you tell the story of your life to yourself. And basically the thing that I write, if it's prose, will lay itself on top of what you would otherwise be thinking. But it will have the same rules as your thought. So it will always be a musical thing.
I've read something that you said you do 150 rewrites. Are you striving to encapsulate that thought or feeling perfectly rather than just give a suggestion to the reader?
Well, it's a craft skill. I mean, creative writing now gets taught as quite often an extension of an English department. It's not really got anything to do with English. It's more like being a bricklayer or laying a hedge or making a thatched roof. It's a very old craft skill. And in order to get it right, you have to do it a lot. You have to, hopefully over the years, you get better at knowing what you're doing generally. I mean, if I look, because now you can with the computer, at how many times I've accessed a file, it will be 100, 120, 150 times. Sometimes I'll just have been looking at it to find out what's going on so that I can go forward, or I'll be moving commas, or it will be very minor. There will be about three major rewrites, and then the rest of it is tweaking and pecking and changing people's names because you've had another idea. I did once, because I sometimes work with students, ask lots of writers, playwright, other prose writers, women who wrote Bonk Busters and Chick Lit. I don't really know what the difference is between that, but she did. So lots and lots of different writers, and we all came up with, there are probably three big rewrites, and there is endless tweaking to try and get it so that it's not a waste of somebody's time, really. You're trying to make something as good as you possibly can. And while you're doing that, hopefully you're learning skills.
Is it becoming easier as you go along?
I mean, it doesn't feel like work, particularly. It feels like being paid to do something that's very enjoyable.
The enjoyment comes out through your writing as well. I mean, you have attracted comment from critics who prefer to see the more negative sides or the more downbeat or miserable sides of your books, but also they are very funny. How bothered are you by the negative reviews that you get from critics?
Well, I mean, there are negative reviews and there are reviews that say I have a negative world view. I can't do anything about either of them. Particularly if it's for a whole book or a novel. I'll have spent 3 years planning that and then about a year writing it and then about a year going through the sort of production process. So any kind of review will be about something that I started doing 5 years ago, and I probably stopped, because it takes a while for books to come out, 3 or 4 years earlier. So whatever I'm doing, it's not going to be influenced now by any kind of comment on something that I've done. And most reviews now, they aren't a writer saying to a writer, look, I think you might think of this or that. It's the reviewing culture's quite strange now. I don't really know what reviews are about. They're certainly not about what... They're sort of about what book it's been decided would be fashionable for you to read at the moment, which doesn't interest me as a reader. And, yeah, it's not really to do with my job.
The soundbite labels like commitment to misery just are... They're taglines to have a hashtag in front of them, aren't they? So it's...
Well, it's true. I mean, when I left university, I'd sort of decided that I wanted to write in order to make money. It was still kind of possible to work with people where you were using writing to make them better or make them find out who they were or make them feel happy, or it was something to do or help them remember things. So I was working in prisons and psychiatric hospitals and rehabilitation centres and with people who had disability and were still at home, people who had a visual impairment of one degree or another. And these were people who were all, you know, could be immensely happy from time to time, but also they're dealing with things that are not wonderful and are really inconvenient. Or they're fine, but the world is not really designed to be extremely helpful. And for about 5 years, that's the people that I wrote with. I didn't write with people who were wearing black pullovers and doing people watching in cafes or suffering for their art. I was dealing with people who, you know, maybe were dying of Huntington's chorea, and they were dying, and that's it. Or a guy who was dying really fast of MS and was really angry about it. And maybe the anger was making him die even faster, but there's nothing he could do about it. I don't think you can spend that much time with that many different people who are supposed to be on the fringes and not important and who are basically almost everybody. Because if you live to be old, you'll have problems. If you don't live to be old, that will be a problem. That's life. The nice, comfy bit with 200 people who meet each other a lot in London is not reality. Life is quite complicated, and then you die. It's not wonderful. And it's quite unsympathetic and unempathetic, I think, to write fiction that's just the Hollywood thing, where good people are rewarded, and if you fall in love correctly, then it will be reciprocated and everything will be fine. As a reader, that doesn't really give me all that many places to go, because I don't recognise that as being very real.
The way you capture those beautiful little spots of time in life where two people who've never met before exchange a moment which is really quite beautiful or helpful or enlightening and then go off in their separate ways. You do it in Serious Sweet, and it shows that London isn't just this big impersonal place. It is full of human beings who can find empathy with each other. It made me wonder that if you ever had a dinner party, would you actually set out to put people who didn't know each other and probably wouldn't get on well with each other next to each other and challenge them not to find something in common?
That sounds like a terrible dinner party. Then again, I've never, ever, ever had a dinner party, so I don't really know. I mean, I do if I know somebody who's fantastically nice and I know somebody else who's fantastically nice, I do tend to try to get them to meet each other. Just because, you know, you think they would make each other happy. That's happened a few times. You kind of think, you have to meet you because you would get something out of it. I don't think it's necessary for me to cook them dinner to do that. I don't really like having people in my house. It's so rare that I'm there. I spend most of my time on trains. It's nice to be in a sort of little bubble.
When you are in your house, when you write, are you very content in the reality that you're creating?
Oh, no, it's awful at the beginning because you're trying to make something out of nothing and get it to fly, and it hasn't got an engine because you haven't invented it yet, and that's quite exhausting. I always forget how tiring it is. You know, I'll maybe do a page in a day. Towards the end, when everything is, and it's not that I haven't planned, I plan enormously, but it's the most psychologically and emotionally taxing form of writing. So it's just really tiring, and you're trying to get everything smoothed out at the beginning and in the order that you know you need it to be. As you go on, more things become more inevitable, and the style's definitely developed, and by the end, I mean, I'll have a couple of cans of Red Bull and then I'll write the last 70 pages basically without going to sleep, you know, for a couple of days. But that's because it's the end. I couldn't do that at the beginning. Well, I could, but it wouldn't be very good. And I'd be really tired.
I'm full of caffeine. Yeah. Do you ever reread your work?
Just because of all the rewriting. You don't want to see it again. You never want to think about it again. The people I like, but hopefully within the story I've got them to do and say and be everything that I was interested in them doing and saying and being. So I'm not... People say, oh, did you miss them? Do you want to go back and write other stories about them? I haven't yet. That simply has not happened yet.
Although I suppose to an extent you did when you recorded the talking book version of Paradise for the RNIB.
Yeah, that's the only time. What you'll do, the book will be published, you'll tour around, you'll read it. You wouldn't normally be able to read the whole of it, but yeah, for the RNIB I did up in Glasgow. Long-term reading out loud, it'd be very unusual unless I mean, the children's book, I've just done the audio book, reading the whole of that being... Four depressed Peruvian llamas and a badger, and it's just, that's quite energetic. But normally, yeah, why on earth would I read this stuff? It's interesting when you get published in Germany or France or somewhere. Suddenly you'll be doing a publicity round, but maybe 5, 6, 7, you know, 10 years after you've written the book. It's peculiar that I can still remember it if I'm required, and I can ask questions about it if I'm required, because it's very deeply somewhere in my head. But otherwise, I, you know, wouldn't think about reading it at all.
And are you a listener to audiobooks, or are you a print reader?
I do like reading. I don't read many... I don't allow many people to read to me, because I love the voice, I love listening to radio. Sometimes the reader's voice just won't be who I thought that voice would sound like. I remember they got somebody Catch-22 is a book I really like, and I think they got, I don't know, Joe Pasquale or somebody to read it. It was just really bizarre. And I've never forgotten how terrible that was. But I've never forgotten how wonderful it was. They got Patrick McGoohan to read The Third Policeman.
Oh, yeah.
Which is just so good. Everything about that was just right. So it would have to be, I mean, now, you know, I do a lot of work with Bill Nye. I would quite happily have him read anything, really. I'm quite upset. He seems to only read Richard Ford, Martin Amis and people.
Maybe he'll be listening to the show and we can nudge him in the right direction.
No, I think it's because there's a convention that if the author's female, no matter who the character is, it will be read by a female person. Sometimes that alters, but yeah, no. I mean, I do radio plays with him.
You clearly enjoy the radio work. I mean, there seems to be a great pleasure that throbs out of the radio whenever I'm listening to that.
Yeah, I mean, I love voice. I'm passionate about getting my own voice to be as much of itself as it could be in any form, whether it's on the page or out loud or whatever. I like doing the shows that I do. I use a particular voice method that I think is very interesting and useful. So, yeah, I'm passionate about it. But, I grew up being a little tiny kid and listening with mother. And technically, it's incredibly free as a form. It's relatively easy to make a finished broadcast. It used to only take 3 months. Now it takes 2 years, but that's because of the commissioning process. And you can have anybody really doing anything in a little room for a day, 2 days, 3 days, and get this extraordinary thing, which the equivalent that would be visual would be this multi-million dollar exercise. And actually you've just got somebody jumping up and down a gravel pit and somebody else is making a noise like a dragon. And but it works as sound.
And it's more inclusive of people who have visual impairments, so you've automatically got 2 million more people. Do you find that an exciting aspect of knowing that your books are being made into audiobooks and that your broadcasts are being broadcast, that you are reaching an audience that you might not otherwise reach?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I know from... This will have changed a bit now, but I mean, it used to be very difficult if you were a young visually impaired person and you wanted books on tape, but a lot of it was geared towards people who'd gone blind older because of diabetes, and it was a lot of Catherine Cookson and stuff that they, that's altered, but you'd like to be there for people to listen. But I think it's much freer and more empowering and intimate for everybody, because the picture that you see might not be the picture that you'd see if you were left to yourself, and the face that you see might not be the face that you see. And obviously, if you'd never seen anything, you're interacting with it in a completely different way, which I think is really beautiful.
There's a lot of sound in your books, and I love that sense that it's not... So many books are just so visually descriptive, and that's fine, and I quite like having the sunsets that I used to be able to see described to me again. But actually, you do inhabit a world where all the senses are alive.
I hope. I mean, everybody has their own personal wiring and a sort of hierarchy. Obviously, visual information, there's a huge amount of your brain and your nerves going into allowing you to see things. But it's a very unintimate form. You know, I could see you if you were standing on a mountaintop. I certainly couldn't touch you, taste you, smell you. It's odd that we're so locked into this very defended, very distant sort of journalistic thing, which is looking at things. I've never been all that interested in that. And plus, I don't have a particularly good grip of the world in a visual way. I mean, I don't remember people by how they look at all, to the point of being rude, where I have met somebody quite a few times. I just won't remember what they look like. I'll remember what they smell like, and I'll remember what their voice sounds like, just because my senses seem to be arranged from smell to sound downwards to things that are less important. I think it's underrepresented. I know that Professor Barry Smith is a smell man. He invited me to a conference, and we just sat there waving our arms in the air while this woman described this tribe in Papua New Guinea, and they can't quite work out why it's a primitive thing that they work on smell, or they're just like me and Barry and they work on smell and they live in a little island, so they've all become people who work on smell. So in the sense that you would say this is rough, this is smooth, and it could be a whole range of things, but it'll have smoothness or roughness, or this is blue and there's a whole range of blueness. They have words like poos, and there will be a whole list of things that have the quality of poos, but it's entirely to do with smell. So it'll be, you know, this is the smell of the dust on hornbill's feathers. This is the smell of bamboo that you shouldn't use to carry water. I mean, it's very bizarre, but hugely joyful to just sit there and go, oh, my God, there are people who understand the world the way I understand the world. It's fantastic. But, you know, hopefully because people, yeah, however they're wired up, experience the world with all of their senses. So why would you not talk about them? And, I mean, I hate it when you get a page of dialogue and nobody's saying how you're saying these things. Because that's almost all the information isn't there. You could say hello in about 93 different ways off the top of your head. And some of them would mean that you wanted to go to bed with somebody, and somebody would mean that you wanted to murder them. It's the same word. So hopefully you're making not a constricting experience for the reader or the listener, but an experience that's sort of three-dimensional.
Yes, painting a full picture of everything that's going on around. Thank you very much, Alison Kennedy.
My pleasure, anytime.
Thanks to Alison Kennedy. Many of her books are available from the RNIB Library, including Sirius Sweet and her own narration of Paradise, which is TB 13755. For more details, visit the website at rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5. It's more than a decade since one of Britain's best-loved humorists, Alan Corran, passed away. With his gentle, often surreal satire, he appeared regularly as a panellist on radio and TV, wrote numerous books, and filled acres of column space in newspapers and magazines. By the late 1990s, he reckoned he'd already written over 6 million words. How do you go about editing that into a best-of anthology? His children, Giles Corran and Victoria Corran Mitchell, let Robert Kirkwood into their secret.
So who's going to write the introduction?
I thought we were doing it together.
I don't know. I've never written with anyone else. He never wrote with anyone else.
It's not that hard. One person types, the other one paces.
And how do we refer to him? If it's a serious essay making a case for his inclusion in the canon, he ought to be referred to as Corran. But that would be weird coming from us.
Well, we can't write our father. That sounds like God. Daddy? We can't call him Daddy. That's just embarrassing.
Maybe it would be better if someone else wrote it. If we do it, it looks like vanity publishing. Any old twonk can die and have his children bind up his writing and say it's great. Maybe we should ask an academic to do the introduction, to give it some gravitas.
He'd like an academic. For a long time, he thought he was going to be one, after all. He spent those 2 years at Yale and Berkeley on the Commonwealth Fellowship.
And there was postgrad at Oxford before he went. And his first was a serious first. I think maybe even the top one in the year. He got that Violet Vaughan Morgan scholarship.
I always confused that with his medal for ballroom dancing.
No, no, that was just called the Junior Bronze.
Giles Corran and Victoria Corran Mitchell reading the introduction to Chocolate and Cuckoo Clocks, The Essential Alan Corran. They recorded it at the RNIB Talking Book Studios in London. And while they were there, I asked them, as there were 85 articles in the book, was it hard to choose what to put in?
It wasn't very hard for me because I made my brother do all the initial reading. And
yeah,
I
provided a kind of digest for her that was... It was basically, I mean, I have to admit, it was just the ones he'd anthologised himself for his 26 volumes, which probably had 50 pieces in each one on average. So that's, what, 1,300 pieces I probably read, each one being about 2,000 words is a quarter of a million words, something like that. And that probably represents, in truth, maybe a tenth of his output, which would have been more like 2.5 million. I mean, there may be pieces from 1968 in bound copies of Punch somewhere that could have borne inclusion, but someone else is going to have to find them.
And you've got them in a chronological order.
We did, because there's quite a development through his career. We divided it into decades, and you see in the 1960s, he hadn't completely committed to being a humorist yet, and some of the pieces are quite serious. He writes about civil rights and racism and social issues of the time. And in the 70s, he starts to become more of a humorist. It's a real commitment there to the jokes. The 80s was his sort of golden age when he started becoming a celebrity. And then the 90s, he'd come home from editing Punch and he was working at home and the comedy's gone very domestic, very Cricklewood-based. And we thought that doing it that way would be quite a good way of almost reflecting his life in a biographical form as well as collecting the pieces.
And we did kind of skew to the golden age in the middle, late 70s through to late 80s, which I think he wouldn't have minded. He'd have known that was his great period. It's like if you buy a sort of a Queen's greatest hits, you're going to get one or two from the silly period in the early 70s, a couple of things from the end, but mostly it's going to be the sort of the five or six glory years in the middle, isn't it, leading up to Live Aid. With him, we did the same thing.
It's going to be the Game album.
Yeah.
There I was in my kitchen in London with the radio on, and I was listening to one of those mad programmes you could only get on the wireless. It was Alan Corran and a friend going round London on buses, just maundering on about things and getting on and off when they felt like it, and just acting like boys, really. Oldish boys. And I heard a bus number I recognised. It was the bus that goes up Our Hill and stops outside our house. And I can't really explain what a thrill it was to hear that master of wit and humour, Mr. Alan Corran, to hear him get off the bus at the top of Our Hill and actually hear the crunch of his humorous feet on our gravel. And if it had been live, and if I'd been gawping out of my bedroom window, I would have been able to see him. And I meant, were I ever to meet him, to say, "Hello, Alan, we've never been introduced, but you got off the bus onto my gravel. And you've made me laugh from when I was 13. Thank you." But I didn't get that opportunity, so writing this is the next best thing.
And it's not just yourself who have recorded introductions. Various sections are introduced by Melvyn Bragg, Victoria Wood, Clive James and Stephen Fry. Did it surprise you that they all wanted to take part?
We were really delighted when they said yes. I mean, we thought, look, when he died, all sorts of amazing people were talking about being fans of his and talking about his work, and we thought it would be very nice to have some voices in the anthology that reflected his, I guess, his kind of cultural status. And we wrote to people that we thought would be appropriate for each decade. We didn't really expect them to say yes. I mean, we expected Clive James and Melvyn Bragg. I would have been surprised if they said no, because they were also friends of his. But Victoria Wood had never even met him, but said she was a big fan of his writing. You know, we'd read that somewhere.
And that was a great thing to get. And I mean, A.A. Gill had said to someone who said to me that, had apparently said, someone had said that they knew me and that I was Alan Corran's son. He said, "Oh, Alan Corran, he's a god." No, he is God. So I thought that A.A. Gill ought to be there.
Now, what clip of a story should I end on?
It's hard, isn't it, to actually, the actual clip. Some of the titles are so good.
It's all brilliant, and you say that. I mean, like my brother said, that my father's complete works are sort of twice the length of Proust, just in the ones that he anthologised. I'm remembering, this was a particular favourite of mine even when I was a kid, there's one about making practical joke phone calls that I love. It's called "Let Us Now Phone Famous Men."
Which is the one with a phone call to Chairman Mao, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, I liked all the Hemingway pastiches, and sometimes he'd pastiche something as well. There's a Hemingway A. Milne pastiche called "The Pooh Also Rises." That's Pooh with an H, I should stress. That's a fantastic one.
That's a point. You mentioned liking his work as a kid. Did you understand a lot of it when you were growing up?
Well, this is the thing. I understood the ones that were silly. That one, "Let Us Now Phone Famous Men," I found it funny because he tries to phone Chairman Mao, he tries to phone the Pope. And
I was waiting. I knew there was a sign of growing up, reading and books and everything were very important in our house, and there was... I knew I was waiting to understand what Daddy wrote. I knew it was a thing I wouldn't, and I always want to. The first one that I... Apart from he wrote children's books, so called the Arthur Westerns, which I read, always thought were a bit boring. They were too slow to start. But the very specifically, I remember picking up a copy of Punch when I was about 11, and it was a new story that a dog had been found living in a council flat for 2 years without anyone knowing, with no owner. And my dad wrote, obviously, a first-person piece by the dog. And at one point, the dog complains about having to drink his morning breakfast out of an avocado-coloured toilet bowl and how boring it was and distasteful. And I remember laughing at that when I was 11 and thinking, aha, maybe I'm grown up now.
Can I just throw in, the Arthur Westerns are not boring. If there are listeners who've got children, it's absolutely worth tracking. We didn't put the children's books in the anthology because we thought they weren't... you know, Giles said that if you were making a compendium of T.S. Eliot's proper stuff, you wouldn't include Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. Mm. So we didn't. But the children's books are hilarious. And
they are. They were. I was into comics when I was 8 years old, and my dad's stories were brilliant. And he used to sort of tell them aloud to me in bed before he wrote them down, and they were fantastic. They were just proper great. He had expectations that children should be able to read and have a bit of patience, and so they sometimes took, I think, 3 or 4 pages, maybe 4 minutes to get to the main action. And my mind used to wander because I was stupid.
He couldn't really read.
Now, amongst other things, you're both journalists. Do you think that was inevitable?
I think it was inevitable simply because, you know, we had two parents. One of them, my mother, was a doctor, got up at 7 in the morning and went off to work and came back exhausted and speckled with blood. And the other one went off to Fleet Street whistling, went out for lunch, came back slightly drunk, spent his daytimes playing cricket in the corridor and occasionally writing. So I think,
I would say unlike Toria, I did try some other things, and only when I'd failed at everything did I end up being a journalist.
But I think an awful lot of people follow their parents into one line of work or another just because it's what's familiar and they can see how it's done. And my dad's life looked infinitely preferable to having a real grown-up job.
And that life is chronicled in Chocolate and Cuckoo Clocks, The Essential Alan Corran, available as an RNIB talking book, read by Peter Noble with an introduction read by Giles Corran and Victoria Corran-Mitchell. For more information on the Talking Book service, head to rnib.org.uk. And Giles and Vicky, thanks so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
I decided to spend the day trying to telephone the leaders of the world. Why not? After all, they had ears like anyone else. They had desks with phones on. They were put in power, more or less, by insignificant souls like me. Surely they could set aside a few seconds for a chat, an exchange of gossip, an acknowledgement that the silent majority had a right, occasionally, to speak. So I phoned Mao Zedong. "Who?" said the girl on 108. International Directory Inquiries. "He's the chairman of the Chinese People's Republic," I said. "It's probably a Peking number." There was a long silence. I could see her there, repolishing an immaculate nail, shoving a wayward curl back beneath her headset, sucking a polo, wondering whether she should go on the pill. "I'll get the supervisor," she said finally. "Nobody ever phones China," said the supervisor. "Why not?" "I don't know," she said. Her voice was diamantine. "I only know why people phone places. I don't know why they don't, do I?" Ruined by syntax, I pled help. "You could phone the Chinese chargé d'affaires in London," she said. "The number is 580-7509. 580-7509 yielded a high-pitched moan. My Chinese may be less than flawless, but even I could tell that no human larynx was involved. I phoned the operator, who phoned the engineer, whose supervisor phoned me. "It's NU," he said. For a moment, I felt excitingly privy to some piece of inside dope about post office / Chinese legation affairs. Clearly, from the man's weary voice, it was old NU up to his tricks again. NU, the tamperer, the Red Guard saboteur. NU, the man who had plagued the GPO for years with his intercepted calls and weird oriental devices fitted out in the legation basement. "Who's NU?" I said. "Not in use," he said. And a small world crashed.
Peter Noble narrating Chocolate and Cuckoo Clocks, The Essential Alan Corran, which is TB18569. Braille and giant print copies are also available from the RNIB library. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, Mark Haddon on curious incidents and short stories. But before that, as you know, here at Read On, we're always keen to hear about the books that you've been reading and how you access them. You can let us know by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk.
And that's precisely what listener Paul Chenell did. Keen to expand my reading horizons, he had an educating read suggestion for me. But first, I asked him a little bit about himself. Paul, welcome to Read On.
Hello, thank you.
So, you were born blind, I believe.
Yes, that's right.
Did you go to one of the blind schools?
Yes, I did, yeah. Yeah, I went to Linden Lodge, which is in South London, and then to do my A-levels, I went up to what was then called Worcester College, which is now New College, I believe, because it's gone co-ed.
Did they help turn you into a keen reader?
Oh, I think so, yeah. Yeah, sure, because although there weren't lots and lots of Braille books, you know, they had a good, reasonably good selection, and of course, obviously, one can use the National Library and Talking Book Service and all that sort of thing. So I think gradually I became a very keen reader, yes.
Well, you say you started with Braille. Did you move quickly onto talking books, or have you always remained committed to Braille?
No, I moved on to audio books a bit later, you know, as a young man, you know, because, you know, there is a limited number of Braille books available, and, you know, became more and more interested and impatient that I couldn't get books. So I moved on to the talking book service and audio books when they became much more fashionable, you know, sort of 40 years ago or whenever it was they started.
Yes, you must have seen quite a change in the shape and style and portability of your audio and talking books over the years.
Oh, good Lord, yeah. When I first started, it was a great big machine which was mains operated, and you know, it was all portable. You stuck it down in a room and sat near it and listened to the book.
And you used
a great big cassette thing. Yeah.
Yes, the cassettes were about the size of videotapes, I remember.
Yeah, big stuff.
You certainly knew when they'd come through the letterbox, didn't
Absolutely,
you?
Yeah, a great thud on the mat.
And I believe that after Worcester College, you went to work for the BBC.
Yes, I made a to be frank, I made a mess of my A levels, didn't do very well at all. So I went to the RNIB Commercial College, which used to be over in Notting Hill Gate, Pembridge Place. I did audio typing there, and then I got a job in the BBC. And it's an interesting job. First of all, I went into what was called the Investigation Unit, which was about half a dozen or a dozen ex-policemen who looked after the security of the BBC buildings. So I used to have to write up their reports about, you know, a break-in or somebody having their wallet stolen or whatever it was. Sometimes the police would contact this investigation unit when they wanted help in terms of crimes carried out in BBC buildings. So I, you know, it's just an audio typing job, but I enjoyed that. And then I moved over to something called the Telephone Unit, where we used to transcribe material for radio programs and also completed radio programs. So that was very enjoyable time as well, you know.
Was that both drama and factual stuff?
Well, lots of factual stuff, yeah. Lots of features programs and also news programs. Lots of stuff about the arts as well, yes, drama and all sorts of things. You know, obviously the BBC does such a wide range of different sorts of broadcasts.
What are the biggest changes that you've noticed over 40 or 50 years in the accessibility of books?
Well, I mean, now not only do we have the talking book service, but there are so many more books on tape that you can get, you know, the different audio books done by various firms, aren't there? And obviously you can go online and get all sorts of books, and, you know, you can use a computer to, there's Kindle and all this sort of thing, you know, the electronic readers. I mean, all that sort of stuff makes it so much more easy for blind or partially sighted people to get the books that they want to read. I mean, I think that's wonderfully good. You know, the technological improvements are excellent. You know.
And is there any particular genre that you favour?
Well, I tend to read a good deal of non-fiction. I'm not a big fiction person, although, I mean, I've been thinking about, you know, various books over the years that I've enjoyed. But I like reading lots of history. I like reading books about music because I'm very keen on, you know, whatever you call it, classical music, art music, or whatever it is. And I like to read about composers and that sort of thing. I will enjoy fiction, but it's not the majority of my interest.
I'm beginning to sense where your suggestion for Educating Red or your hidden gem might be leading to. So would you like to tell me what you would recommend that I should read in the next couple of weeks?
Well, the book that I've known for many years, Delius as I Knew Him, and it's about the working relationship and friendship between the English composer, or the English-born composer, I should say, Frederick Delius, and Eric Fenby. And it was written by Eric Fenby a couple of years after Delius died, and he wrote it, and it became very popular in the 1930s, and it's been brought out again. It's been brought out in new editions a couple of times since then. And it's just a fascinating read. And what it is not great literature. It's just Fenby talking about his time with Delius. It made a very big impression on him. And so it's sort of reportage. It's a person with a story and very successfully putting that story down onto paper. And it reads really well. And I don't think you have to be someone who is very keen on classical music to enjoy. I think anyone who's interested in any of the arts might enjoy the book, because it's a fascinating story, because Delius, in the last 6 or 7 years of his life, was totally blind, was paraplegic. In fact, I think he was quadriplegic. He had no use of his hands or legs because he was suffering from syphilis. And so consequently, he needed all sorts of personal care and help. But what Fenby did, Fenby read in the press about Delius having this disease and being very ill, and having several pieces of music that he started to write and not been able to complete. Fenby wrote basically a fan letter to Delius, because he heard some of the music, and offered his help, and received a reply and was invited down to Delius's house in Grez-sur-Loing, which is near Fontainebleau in France, and they became friends, or certainly Delius was very welcoming, and they began to work together. And the book is about the last 6 years of Delius's life, when for quite a long while, within that 6 years, Fenby lived with him and helped him to complete the incomplete musical scores. It's just a fascinating read. It's a very good narrative. It describes how they work together, describes the household, describes he talks about his impressions of the man, and they become quite close as friends, Delius and Fenby, and Delius's wife as well becomes very friendly with Eric Fenby. And I was just captivated when I first read this 40, 45 years ago, and I've read the book on a number of occasions, because it's just sort of fascinating story. You know, over the years I've come to greatly enjoy the music by Delius, and it's just interesting to see how these two people, two vastly different people they were, you know, were able to work together to finish these. In fact, they actually wrote a couple of compositions together, and to say Fenby helped Delius to write a couple of compositions right at the end of his life. And so, I mean, it's just fascinating to see how that's possible.
Well, it sounds like a terrific read, and perfect as a suggestion for Educating Red. Having checked the RNIB library, it is available as a talking book. So hopefully some of the listeners can read on along with me. If you could give me 3 or 4 weeks to read it and gather my thoughts, then I shall give you another call and look forward to getting you back on the show.
That's excellent. I look forward to that.
Well, Paul Chennell, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
D
Cordelius as I Knew Him, written by Robert Fenby and narrated by Derek Chandler, is TB4236. I've already downloaded it via Overdrive and I'm looking forward to listening to what sounds like an excellent educating read suggestion. Thanks again to Paul Chanel. Do you have a book that you think would expand my reading horizons? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
Mark Haddon is best known for his novel The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, which has been a runaway success since its publication in 2003. He's gone on to write several other books for adults and for children, most recently The Pier Falls, his first collection of short stories. He spoke to RNIB reporter Claire Carson.
So The Pier Falls is my first collection of short stories, which have been written over the last, 8 or 9 years. I think what most readers will tell you what binds them together is a fairly grim outlook on life. There's a lot of death in there. But I think, you know, without fiction you can't have death. Alongside death and some fairly grim events, I hope there's a lot of empathy for people in difficult situations, because I think that's what I am most interested in, above all else.
What I've found when reading it is the most sensational ability to get inside the minds of people in these incredible situations and to talk with such knowledge and depth of feeling. How did you create that versatility?
I think it comes down to simple human nosiness. I am perpetually fascinated by other people's lives. I love listening to other people's stories. I soak them up more than the news. I'm the person who always turns to any column called Experience or Personal Experience in a magazine. I spend a lot of my time thinking about people in those situations. And a lot of these stories have come from seeing a news article, hearing just a snippet of a story from someone and thinking to myself, what would it really be like if that happened to you?
So take The Pier Falls. We're back in 1970. We know that Brighton Pier was shut at that point, but in your story, the pier collapses. Talk us through that.
This story has a slightly longer genesis. As a child, my sister and I always went on two holidays, one with a classic Mediterranean holiday with our parents, with prawn cocktails and sunburn, you know, the kind. The other holiday we had was a week in Brighton, a proper old-fashioned working-class holiday with my father's parents, where we went on the ghost train and ate candy floss and played Shove Halfpenny on the Pier. I've been trying to write about it for a long time, but everything came out a little too coy and respectful and nice. And it took me a long time to realize that instead of trying to recreate this pier and that holiday for the readers, if on paper I simply destroyed the place, I had a lot more fun. I mean, it's quite fun destroying things on paper. But the strange thing I discovered is that to destroy something on paper, you have to pay the same loving attention to detail as you do when you build something up.
It's almost a minute-by-minute account of what happens in a report.
It's just written from a sort of God's eye perspective, isn't it? We're watching a terrible, terrible thing happening. And in fact, only as I talk to you now do I realise that similarly, when you destroy something on paper, you have to pay loving attention to detail. There's something about when people are losing their lives in a situation like this that makes you very aware of what it means to be alive. A lot of people die in that story. But I have a sense of who those people were, as if in their last moments, you suddenly get a vision of what it meant to be that person.
Do you, as well as understanding human nature and how humans operate in difficult situations, do you do lots of detail? Because moving on to a different of the short stories, is set way into the future, and on board the ship, the Halcyon, one of the people has to do operate, take an appendix out with magnificent detail. Do you take the time to understand how the operation happens?
My good friend Simon Stevens, who wrote the stage adaptation of Curious Incident, who's a wonderful writer, albeit in a different form, he once explained to me something which has stuck in my mind ever since. There's a play of his called Motor Town, and there's one scene in that which involves a gun. And he said, the only research I did for that play was about the gun, and I made sure I got every little detail about the gun right. And the people watching the play think, ooh, he knows about guns. And once the audience think that, they think he knows about everything else. And I've often found that in a story, if you do too much research, you kill something stone dead. But if you focus that research on one detail, you can make readers think, I hope, that they really know what they're talking about. And I spent a good deal of time working out via YouTube and lots of websites exactly how to do an appendectomy yourself at home. You can call on me in an emergency.
Yes. Oh, that's tremendous.
But there's another story which lies behind that, which I find quite fascinating, is that my younger son and I went to a sort of science conference, and we met a young man who'd signed up for the Mars One project. He had therefore signed away his life to go to Mars. What most people don't realise is you can't get back from Mars. There's no petrol station on Mars. You can't refill the rocket and blast off again. It's a one-way trip. So he had signed up, in effect, to die on Mars. And my young son, who was about 9 at the time, said, what do your mum and dad think about it? He said, oh, I think they're okay about it. And we both got rather sort of tearful after this meeting. And I think that was the germ of the story, thinking, what a profoundly odd and sad thing to do, to think that I will leave Earth for the last time.
Of course, so famously wrote The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. Where did that idea come from?
I'm always embarrassed to admit this. The idea came from me having rejected a previous novel. I'd written about 5 previous novels which simply did not work, and I must get around to tracking them down and burning them before someone finds them if I go under a bus. I wanted to write a novel that worked, and I gradually learned that you have to make the opening of a novel grab a reader's attention and never let go. And I wrote 3 separate opening pages to a novel. I've forgotten what the other 2 were now, but the first was simply a description of a dog impaled on someone's lawn with a fork through it. I'm ashamed to admit that I found it very funny. And in fact, I remember my wife at the time saying, I heard you laughing upstairs. And I explained what I'd just written, and she said, do you think real writers laugh at their own jokes? Which I've never let her forget. But once I had that image, I began to realize that it was only funny if it was described in a voice which didn't understand that it was funny. You know that flat voice that all really good comedians have?
Yes.
It's the opposite of laughing at your own jokes. It's telling a joke and insisting with your tone of voice that it is not funny, which in fact makes it slightly funnier. And I got that voice, and then I had to look for someone who might own that voice. And strangely, Christopher, the central character, came along as the owner of a voice which I'd already come up with.
And how incredible to tell the whole story. I just love the way of, again, getting right inside the mind, which seems to me to be a great hallmark of your work.
Strange, isn't it? I mean, people often talk about getting inside the mind of someone. Particularly when I'm teaching writing, I often say, don't think about getting inside the mind. Don't think about sort of character and atmosphere, but think about concrete detail. That's always what draws us in as readers. If you get the tiny things right, in the play version of Curious Incident, there's one little detail which has been taken literally out of it, and it always causes the audience to laugh. When the first policeman comes on stage to find out what's happened, why is this boy kneeling by a dog with a fork through it? In the book, it describes the policeman simply by saying what his shoes were like, and then it said he had a big red leaf sticking to the sole of his shoe. and the policeman walks on stage and there's a big red leaf sticking to the sole of his shoe. And the audience always laughs. And it's that, it's suddenly incredibly real.
Yes.
The tiny, we think there's a real policeman, not because we're in his mind, not because we understand him, but because he has a leaf sticking to his shoe.
Well, I was going to ask, what next?
Well, what next? What next is a book that was published last week, in fact. 100 years ago, Virginia Woolf and Leonard Woolf set up Hogarth Press, physically printing books on their dining table in Richmond. The first book was called Two Stories. It contained a story by Virginia Woolf called The Mark on the Wall, and there was also a story in there by Leonard. Hogarth Press wanted to celebrate the centenary, so they asked me to write a short story to go with Virginia Woolf's The Mark on the Wall, and again to bring it out in a volume called Two Stories. They know how much I love the work of Virginia Woolf and how much I return to over and over. So it was a slightly scary challenge. I did it. It's a short story called St. Bride's Bay. And they've made it as this very, very beautiful book, which is not just a celebration of Virginia Woolf, but I think a celebration of the physical book as well. So my last book was a team effort with Virginia Woolf.
How very special. Just one final question is that we love to know if any author has any connection with sight loss.
I have a good friend, in fact, who suffered from macular degeneration for many years and has very little sight left now. So I talked to him a lot about it. And in fact, I talked to him in particular about his ongoing battle for decent audiobooks. I know the RNIB do a service, and he's obviously very grateful for that. I think what he finds frustrating is that there aren't more unabridged literary books available for download, and I think he really champs at that bit because he gets stuck listening to abridged versions of books that he would once have wolfed down in the complete version.
Mm. And how do you yourself feel then in the importance of having your books translated into an accessible format?
Well, I know from talking to my good friend how incredibly tiring it is just to not be able to see. And being as normal as possible for him is hugely important. You know, he needs to read what everyone else can read, full stop.
Thanks to Mark Haddon and Claire Carson. Alas, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our previous shows are there, packed with book news, reviews and author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk. So, farewell until next week, and remember to read on.